vice versa. So how Mother Nature straightens that all out when it becomes a free space wave and finally is transmitted far away from your antenna, that's relatively easy to understand. But in the reactive near field, up close, what is really happening? I'm convinced that that ferrite rod is a pure H-field generator. I'm slowly being convinced that the majority of what a dipole does is more of an H-field generator than an E-field generator. I'll give you another example of that, and then I'm going to turn it over to Glenn. If I wanted to make a pure E-field in space, I can easily do that. I take two round metallic spheres, I space them 1 meter apart, I pour a whole bunch of electrons into one sphere, I take a whole lot of electrons away from the other sphere. In other words, I've given a whole lot of negative charge to one, I've created a whole lot of positive charge on the other, and I got the 1 meter apart, and by the laws of conservation of energy or Faraday's laws, I could easily figure out what is the volts per meter between my two magnetic spheres. I've now created a steady state E-field in space. I'm not transmitting with it yet. I'm just doing the very first step. I'm making a steady state E-field with these two spheres, and notice that it takes electrons to do it. Let me drop. No matter what I use in free space, spheres, wires, or whatever, if I don't add electrons to one point in space and take the electrons away from the other point in space, I don't think I can create an E-field in space. I can't create an E-field without electrons. And now if I'm rapidly adding and subtracting electrons from one sphere and subtracting and adding electrons to the other sphere, I can make a varying electrostatic field. And I can start something that looks like the first step of transmitting. And in theory, I could transmit a wave, electromagnetic wave, TEM wave, by doing that. It'd be a very difficult process, but I could do it. The first two spheres could be the tips of my dipole, and I put a piece of wire between the two and a transmission line in the middle of it, and I'm now slowly flipping over to launching and subtracting electrons from my two spheres, and I'm, in theory, launching an E-field to begin the transmitting process. But let me show you the next step that's bothering me. I personally set up electronics to listen to the Apollo 15 and 16 astronauts when they were standing on the surface of the moon transmitting a 2,800 megacycle signal, and I know for a fact that that signal they transmitted was a 10-watt transmitter on the surface of the moon, 250,000 miles away. I'm sitting down here with my 12-foot homebrew dish in Farmingdale connected to a spectrum analyzer, which was the front end, and to a bunch of other electronics I threw together, and I listened to astronaut audio. Let me drop. The thing that amazed me is that during that transmission, and you guys have heard me say this before, there's 250,000 miles of extremely empty space between the Earth and the Moon. It's the hardest vacuum you and I are like. You can't produce a vacuum that good in your laboratory. It's an extremely good vacuum. Not the best in the universe, but an extremely good one. There wasn't one single molecule of anything in that translunar space, in the space between Earth and Moon, before they started transmitting, during the transmission, and after the transmission. Not one single electron left that antenna on the moon, and yet they transmitted a wave to me. Was that an electrostatic wave? I don't think so. They didn't use electrons. I think the magnetic is the majority of what a TEM wave is. Without a doubt, they created a local magnetic field. That eventually got straightened out because it is changing real rapidly after it left the antenna, and it generated the rate of change of the magnetic field generated an E-field, but there were no electrons involved. We call it photons, we call it energy, we call it radio signal, we give it all kinds of fancy words. Not one electron left that moon. I'm beginning to think that real transmitting antennas, with rare exception, create a strong, local, changing magnetic field to begin the transmitting process. You can sort of do it with E-field with some of the kinds of antennas, but I think the majority of them do it by transmitting a magnetic field. That loop stick is just a strong hint of what's going on. I've got the whole story.
Dick, what about a Faraday cage in that case?
You create a what you and I would call a Faraday cage, which I call a screen room. A screen room really stops all kinds of radiation, electrostatic, electromagnetic, and everything. A real good screen room is a 100 dB shield that cavity of your microwave oven comes close to meeting those characteristics. With 750 watts of 2,500 meg energy bouncing around inside of your microwave oven, and your specimen, your food, is what finally absorbs it. And if the magnetic field, if the microwave oven as a Faraday cage is effective enough, if it's effective enough, nothing gets out of there. So is the Faraday cage stopping the E field? Is it stopping the H field? The answer is yes, it's stopping both. I know that, first of all, Glenn wanted to make some comments on this. As you can see, Glenn, I'm slowly developing a very different slant as to what a real transmitted radio wave is. I'm amazed that this many years downrange, I'm getting such a different attitude as to what I think it is. KC2QIQ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KYW.
You got it, Mel. Glenn first. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, very good, Dick. Just a couple of quick things I just wanted to add to this, too, is that when you have the E field converting to the magnetic hysteresis field in between, that connection right there is actually called the permissivity. And also, what's also interesting to remember, too, about the electromagnetic field is that it's really got two parts to it. You got the flux density, and you also have the your B and H, and the relationship of B to H is mu sub O, which is permeability, what we were talking about earlier. And I know that when we talk about relationships of B to H, B divided by H, to come up with mu sub O, we always say, okay, in free space, that's 1. But 1 is just a normalization. It's got a real geometry. In other words, mu sub O is really 4 pi times 10 to the minus 7 Oersteds per meter. And the B field can also be related to 1 over 377, which is the resistance of radiation resistance in free space. So when you put those together, that'll give you a little bit better understanding of a building and collapsing electromagnetic or electrostatic field changing rate in free space. KC2QIQ.
KC2 Zulu Golf, Zulu with a question.
Zulu Golf Zulu, you're after Mel. Which is going to be after Glenn. You're on the list, though. People listening to us may not know what B and H is, Glenn. We roll it off the tongue real fast. I'm going to simplistically say something, and I'm going to give you an opportunity to agree or disagree. We create, usually, in our laboratory on our desk, if I want to create a magnetic field, I want to create a magnetic field starting with my coil of wire and my battery, and the amount of magnetic field I create, the primary mover for generating the magnetic field, you and I call it ampere turns. So I've got a certain number of turns of wire, I'm putting a certain number of amperes through it, and that is something strongly related to B, I could call it ampere turns. Depending on the amount of magnetic material nearby, the local permeability, that number of ampere turns of primary mover ends up with a certain amount of resultant magnetic field that you and I call H. And we can relate H into amps per meter, among other kinds of units. So when we talk about the B-H curve, I call B the primary mover and H the result. I know it's overly simplistic, but is it close? KC2QIQ, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Yes, I think it is. It's close, but there's more to it. And in other words, like, B by itself is standalone. I mean, when you're talking about, you know, creating an electrical current and then producing, a flux density, that's very, very close to the electrical side or the E side. But when something is radiating in space, you're very, very far away from the E side anymore. So in other words, now B is just the flux density. So when you're looking at flux density over the field strength. So in other words, now you've got two units that don't have anything to do with E anymore. In other words, now you just basically have a flux density and a field strength. And now if they're moving at a frequency, in other words, you've got an RF frequency or a carrier moving this thing where it's building up and down at that rate. The first one builds in one polarity and the next one builds at right angles to it. And it just continues on its way down and disperses at inverse square law. So, I mean, it's a very, very interesting relationship between B and H, and it just so happens that B and H is the permeability of free space, which is that it's a real geometry. It's, you know, 4 pi times 10 to the minus 7, you know, Oersteds per meter. And B can either be in Tesla or Gauss, and then that gives you, you know, its amplitude. And, you know, there again, and when you relate B back to its geometry or susceptibility to radiating resistance, it's 1 over 377. So you start putting those all together, it gives you a little bit better picture of the geometry of that electromagnetic, electrostatic field in free space. KC2, QIQ.
That is more there, and they are not teaching it in schools.
Yeah, they're certainly not teaching this. When you start using the vocabulary of magnetic fields, lines of force, Tesla, Gauss, Weber, amps per meter, Oersteds, you use any of the vocabulary words of magnetic fields, the majority of electronic engineers and an even bigger majority of ham radio operators will have a blank look on their face. They don't have a good gut feel for what those words mean, and I'm one of them. And I'm suddenly recognizing the fact that what these guys, Wesley and John, are doing, are digging into an area where there's a huge hole in our vocabulary, our knowledge, the schooling that we've had. The magnetics is really the work doer of all of the machinery and all of the electronics that we use. The magnetics does the work, and we know almost nothing about the magnetics.
It's the transducer, Dick.
The transducer is what's doing the work. That's where the rubber meets the road, so to speak. The battery stores the energy. Your switching network and your power supplies and whatever controls the way the energy is delivered to the motor, but it's the magnetics of the motor. It's the magnetics of the motor that turns the wheel that moves the car. It's the magnetics of the loudspeaker. It's the magnetics of the earphones that moves the air that allows you to hear the sound. The magnetics does the work. The magnetics in the power transformer takes what Loco and Con Ed supplies to you and allows you to convert it to a form that you can use. Magnetics is damn important. The magnetics is damn important. We're very light in knowledge about magnetics. I wonder if you've come to any of these conclusions in the past, Mel. K2KEY. You're the next person, then Alex after that. K2KEY, K2RIW. Go ahead, Mel.
No, this is K2KEY. Let's take this back to, you know, really basic, because talking about free space and things like that, let's talk about down to earth what we can know, and maybe I'll understand a little bit. That the pattern, let's take the designation of the electric symbol E and the magnetic symbol H, lines of force, lie respectively. Would you agree with that, first of all, over?
I think I agree with it, Mel. That E field, that radio wave that came from space, from the moon, and came down to me in Farmingdale, and I listened to it, or the radio wave that comes from this repeater that you're listening to and goes over to your street in Brooklyn, and it arrives at your antenna, it has an E field that is perpendicular to the propagation, has an H field that's perpendicular to the propagation, and the E or H are perpendicular to each other. If you could see that wave coming at you, and you could stop it at one instant of time and study it, it would be a flat sheet of material coming at you where the flat sheet is coming straight at you, if you know what I mean, and if it was a vertically polarized wave, the lines of E would be up and down, the lines of H would be left and right, and it's a flat sheet of metal, of material, for that one cycle of that wave that comes toward you. The very next cycle is the very next sheet. There's a whole bunch of these sheets stacked up, and it's coming toward you, and your antenna picks up that energy. K2KEY, K2RIW, that's one way I look at it. Go ahead, Mel.
KC2QIQ with a comment.
Glenn recognized, but Mel first. Go ahead.
Okay, wait a minute. Let's stay with this for a minute, please. How was I going to put it? The pattern, okay, let's call it the pattern, in the plane containing the axis of the antenna. Could we call that the E? Do we agree that's the E plane pattern? And let me get to the next point first, Would that be agreeable, Dick? Over.
I think I see where you're going, and there's a danger, Mel. When it comes to the far field antenna pattern of any antenna you and I use, whether I measure the E field pattern or the H field pattern, when I'm in the far field, it better be the exact same pattern. To take a simplistic example of a flashlight. A flashlight is aiming energy due north. I could talk about the E field energy of that flashlight beam or the H field energy, and I could talk about the pattern of that flashlight beam. The E field pattern and the H field pattern in the far field must be identical. I've got some pretty strong feeling on that one. Maybe you disagree. Over to you, Mel.
Okay. I guess I'm going to go back to Jurassic book again. The way I understood it, he said, basically, and I've been using this as a gospel, now he's going to tell me I'm all wrong. the axis of the antenna would be the E-plane pattern, and the plane perpendicular to this axis would be called the H-plane pattern. I mean, is that what you're questioning, Dick? Over.
WS2N.
Paul, you're on the list. There's a whole bunch of people here. We're gonna slowly get to all you guys. Hang in there. The axis of the antenna. In the case of a Yagi antenna, the boom of the antenna is the axis of the antenna. That is the bore site of the antenna. In that boom direction, in that bore site direction of this Yagi antenna, that's aimed at the Manhattan Beach right now, we'll say, there is no E-field in that axis. There is no H-field in that axis. Parallel to that boom, there is a pointing vector. The E for my vertically polarized Yagi, the E is up and down. The H is left and right. But in the axis, there is no E and there's no H. That's why it's called transverse electromagnetic wave. Transverse means the electric is transverse to the direction of propagation. The H is transverse to the direction of propagation. There is no E and there is no H in the direction of propagation. That's why it's called transverse electromagnetic. They could have called it transverse magnetic electric. Wouldn't make any difference. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, well, all the previous, whatever I've read, now you're starting to show something a little different. The E line always supposedly represented the polarization of the antenna. Am I correct in that assumption? Over.
Absolutely, but there's a catch. By IEEE gentlemen's agreement, when it comes to polarization, they decided to define the E as the polarization that they will name. If we say it's a vertically polarized antenna, we mean that that antenna launches a vertically polarized E field. That's a gentleman's agreement among the IEEE people for a definition. There's a 50-50 chance they could have chosen H, and everything would have been at right angles. But because we're all so light on H knowledge, I'm getting some very strong impressions as to why they chose E to be the standard. Now, I've read lots of antenna books where the wording of how they describe an electromagnetic wave, a radio wave, can easily lead you to believe that there's an E field in the axis or there's an H field in the axis direction, the direction of propagation, or the direction of the axis of the antenna, the boom of a Yagi, so to speak. There's wording that they use that can lead you down that straight path very easily. But once you back off far enough and figure out what the heck is going on, the E and the H must both be transverse for it to be a TEM wave by that definition. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Are you thinking this is strictly, in other words, this theory, is it strictly for free space? Or is this actually, you feel that it applies to average, you know, what we're doing, free space to me is, you know, is something that I very hard for me to, you know, comprehend, because, you know, what is space? You know, what's up, down, what's right, left? That's the problem, you know. So I can only picture it here at Earth level 6. Over.
And 98% of all of the environment you and I live with, radio-wise, is free space, Mel. Even though it contains air and ozone and smog and everything else, oil fumes and whatever, it is radio-wise free space. Most of the frequencies you and I use don't give a darn about whether or not they're going through the vacuum between Earth and Moon, or whether they're going through the air mass between the Manhattan Beach where you live and Huntington where I live, to that radio wave that is free space, with one slight exception. There's always ground reflection. There's always reflection off the building. There's always some multipath. For the most part, the multipath is the second order effect. The primary transmission you and I care about, all of that air between your house and my house, for all practical purposes, if we had line of sight, is free space. Over to you, Mel.
Okay, stay with me. When you look at, you know, all these azimuth patterns, we are actually looking at an E-plane pattern, I assume. Now, where it represents, let's see, now, if we were looking at, let's say, what would we say then? Yeah, okay. The E-plane, is that actually all we're looking at when they say, you know, we're looking at a antenna pattern, free space E-plane radiation. Is that correct? Over.
Lou also recognized, we got a whole list of people here that all want to make comments on this. I don't blame you guys. This is a hot subject we're on right now. Stand by a second, I want to get a beep. By gentleman's agreement, when it comes to polarization, we describe the polarization as that direction of the E field. It was a 50-50 chance. Had we all been smart enough, we could have, as the IEEE people, have defined the H field as the defining direction of polarization. Now, that's polarization, that's E field. When I measure the pattern, the sensing antenna I use on my antenna range is a power detecting device, with rare exception. That feed horn, you and I emphasize in our brain the fact that there's a little E-field probe in that waveguide, the coax adapter, and that there's an E-field in our mind flowing down that transmission line that goes into the sensing equipment that allows you to plot the antenna pattern. Well, that transmission line has also got a magnetic field. That waveguide has got a magnetic field. The magnetic field in the waveguide was part of what that probe was picking up. That sensing antenna on your antenna range is a power sensing device. How much watts per square meter are you transmitting in that direction? That's what the antenna pattern is. It's a power pattern. We can convert it to E, we can convert it to H, we can convert it to gobbles to Google if you want to. It doesn't matter. It is a power sensing device. So that pattern is, we call it the E plane, because if the antenna is horizontally polarized, and I swing the antenna in azimuth, I'm swinging it in the plane of the E field when I measure that pattern. And if I then move it up and down in elevation, I call that the H field pattern, because I'm moving it in the plane where the H field is. But just because I call it the H field pattern, that
repeater, timeout, cancel.
When I measure the elevation pattern and I call it the H field pattern, it doesn't mean that I measured H. When I swing it in azimuth and I measure what I call the E field pattern, it doesn't mean I only measured E. That's the plane at which I moved the motors on the positioner for the antenna on this antenna range, but my sensing device that measured the three-dimensional antenna pattern of the antenna was a power sensing device. It wasn't measuring only E, it wasn't measuring only H. It was measuring the product of E cross H, the pointing vector, which gave you a certain amount of power into your sensing device. It is a power pattern that you measured. I know a lot of people have a lot of confusion on this one, though. K2KEY. K2EY, K2RIW.
Okay, one more point, and then we'll turn it over to the other stations. I don't want to monopolize it. All right. Reference to the horizontal, the horizon of the Earth. The horizon of the Earth. The H-plane pattern is usually called the elevation pattern. Now, I know for a fact that according to Jasek's book, he said a lot of their engineering was done with the antenna orientation with respect to a point basically overhead using the zenith angle, which would mean that the elevation angle is computed by subtracting the zenith angle from 90 degrees. Would that be correct, over?
Oh boy, you hit a beauty. I know everybody's got a lot of things they want to say on this. We're on a very hot subject here. When it comes to the majority of the American-born antenna ranges of respect that I know about, and that includes the Romeo Development Center that I worked at, the Bedingfield Anechoic Facility at Edwards Air Force Base, the Great Big Antenna Range that's at Point Magoo. I've worked on that one a little bit. I've worked on the one at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Most of the antenna ranges will define 0 degrees of the antenna pattern as the zenith straight up, and therefore when you want to measure what the antenna pattern looks like when the antenna is aimed at the horizon, you're measuring the 90 degree pattern, great circle cut, 90 degrees from zenith. That's the way the majority of antenna people think. Now you got a problem. You walk into the antenna range at the Romeo Development Center, which is Air Force people, and to them, all of their antenna patterns are with reference to the pilot. The nose of the airplane is the 0 degree angle of that antenna. To an antenna person, that's 90 degrees down in elevation from zenith. So you've got the Air Force definition of your axes, your defining axes for the antenna pattern, and you've got the rest of the world of antenna people. I think the Navy is somewhere in between the two, and they flip back and forth. So you've got a huge definition problem, and therefore at the beginning of every single, let me drop, every one of the antenna reports written by the Air Force that I've read, the first few pages will tell you that this is the Air Force definition of the axes. It's pilot referenced, not zenith referenced, but the rest of the antenna world references everything to zenith. So you got a bit of a problem, but whether you call it the E-field pattern or the H-field pattern, again, only has meaning when it comes to a horizontally polarized antenna. If it's a vertically polarized antenna, those two flip in definition. Therefore, they'll call it the rogue fader pattern, the antenna people. One is elevation and one is azimuth rotation, but again, the reference point is zenith. So when it comes to the axes and definition and which one you're sweeping, and is it a great circle cut or a conic cut, is it Air Force or is it the rest of the antenna world, you can tell there's a huge definition problem here, Mel. K2KEY, and I've run into some of it, K2RIW.
Yeah, Roger. Yeah, that's it. I know. Very confusing. All right, let me stop at this point, because I don't want to get into things like nulls and all, where now comes in the polar coordinates when you start with the points on a pattern where the radiation is zero, and better known as nulls. But let's leave that for a minute. Take up the questions first, Dick, over.
But let me reiterate, Mel, every antenna pattern you and I care about, whether it be your flashlight, your Yagi antenna, your cubicle quad, your loop, whatever. Whatever we talk about of an antenna pattern, we can call it the E-field pattern, the H-field pattern. That's a gentleman's agreement for that particular polarization of antenna and were you sweeping an azimuth and elevation when you took that flat plane cut of the antenna. And if you were representing the antenna pattern as a true three-dimensional object in space, and with computer-generated graphics, you can draw the three-dimensional antenna pattern these days. And most of our high-gain antenna patterns, the main lobe is a great big cucumber in space. It's a solid three-dimensional object, which has got a certain horizontal beam width and a certain vertical beam width. So so to speak. And the nulls in that pattern are where the power in that direction goes to zero. Did the E field go to zero? Yes. Did the H field go to zero? Yes. Did the power go to zero? Yes. Did the pointing vector, which is E cross H, go to zero? Yea, verily. At each one of those nulls, all power transmitted by that antenna in the far field in that direction, all power went to zero. You can call it E, you can call it H, you can call it rho, you can call it theta, you can call it anything you want. All power in that direction went to zero. Does that make some sense before we leave that one? Because you hit another hot subject there, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yes, of course. That's what I mean. That's when we start getting into now the lobes. And the main lobe and I better leave it because I'm going to get deeper and deeper in, I see already, because I got a couple of questions about now the lobes of an antenna, the nulls and the lobes, and how they come into existence. Please pick up the other station stick. Over.
I'm going to throw in a couple more words. On most antenna patterns, with rare exceptions, if I'm taking a pure, flat, plane cut through this three-dimensional object, in other words, the real antenna pattern is a three-dimensional object. You could call it a sphere with hills and valleys on it, where the tops of the mountains represent the strong signal transmitting directions and the valleys represent the nulls. And if you're using something called a SATAMO machine, which is one of these computer-generated graphics, three-dimensional antenna pattern things that's now becoming popular, a third of a megabuck machine, it gives you a three-dimensional antenna pattern. Some of your MATLAB does that also, and the pattern looks like a bumpy apple. So a real antenna pattern is a three-dimensional object. If I choose to take a slice through it, and that's what I'm doing when on my positioner, I rotate the antenna only in azimuth. I'm taking a slice through the great circle cut through that spherical object called antenna pattern. And I get some main lobe, first side lobe, another null, another side lobe, another null, another side lobe. In general, each of the side lobes are opposite in phase. That's a crazy one. If I call the main lobe the in-phase response, and I slowly slot sweeping from the main lobe, boresight, down the skirt of the main lobe, and I go into that first null, and I start picking up the first side lobe. That first side lobe is 180 degrees out of phase with the main lobe. And then I go over to the next null and into the next side lobe, the second side lobe, will be back in phase. In general, each of those lobes are 180 degrees out of phase with the adjacent lobes. And there's a good explanation for why that happens. A little bit deep, you go there right now. One of the better kept secrets of antenna measurements. Glenn, I know you've got about two or three questions by now, and Alex after that, and then it's going...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
And it's going to be Lou after that, in that order. Glenn first, KC2QIQ, go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, very good, Dick. I think where most people get confused in this one is that, you know, we're mixing a lot of different terms here. You know, we talk about an antenna and an E-field. Then we talk about the radiating electromagnetic wave in free space, and we're talking about, you know, a BH kind of an arrangement in free space. And then, of course, there's propagation. And when all of those terms get mixed and thrown in together, and they're all and polarization, it's very, very hard to understand what's happening with the basic electromagnetic wave. So, you know, here again, you know, what's happening with that B and H in free space or into a vacuum, and how the wave is really moving. That true inverse square law is one thing. But then, of course, you have the issues here on Mother Earth where we're on a ground plane called Mother Earth, and we have an ionosphere. And you mix that together, and now you've got a radio horizon, which almost gives, like, the properties of something very, very similar to a waveguide. Mother Earth is almost like a waveguide along itself. Out in free space, you get a totally different characteristic of propagation because there is no effective ground plane like Mother Earth and an ionosphere. So I think that's where most of the confusion comes in because people are trying to look at an antenna pattern and trying to figure out propagation, and then you want to go back to the basic levels and looking at the BH curve, and each one has to be basically looked at individually and, you know, looked at it in the parts and then put it all back together again, and then it starts to make sense. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Okay, we have to go slow, define our terms. A zillion people will work in the field, use the vocabulary glibly, it rolls out of the mouth at 150 words a minute, and they make the mistake of assuming everyone in their listening audience is understanding what they say. And I know the Air Force people, for instance, ran into a whole lot of problems where they thought their listening audience was hearing A, and they were really hearing B, because they were taking the words the Air Force person was saying and interpreting it, reconverting it to their language. And to get around that problem, many of the well-written Air Force manuals on antenna patterns of installed antennas on an aircraft, the first few pages of the manual say, this is the coordinate system we use for the rest of this manual. It is pilot referenced. It is very different than the normal antenna range measurement techniques that are used outside of the Department of Defense. Because, as I said, they recognized that a lot of misinterpretation was taking place. But those guys in Brooklyn, they're pretty sharp. Alex is going to straighten us out on some of this jazz, I hope. KC2, Zulu, Golf Zulu. Go right ahead, Alex. K2RIW in the TechNet.
You bet I'm going to straight you out. Everybody, please switch on your tape recorder, because I'm going to, in about a minute, I'm going to show you how to get a Nobel Prize. Just one question, and please answer me yes or no, and then I show you my theory part. Do electrons have a mass? Go ahead.
Since Rutherford, among others, measured the mass to charge ratio, and he came up with a real number, he thinks, and a whole lot of other people doing a similar experiment, assume that the mass to charge ratio, and they knew the amount of charge, 10 to the minus 19 coulomb for an electron, therefore you can define something that looks like mass. But mass is usually defined for something that is sitting still. And that electron, you could say, never sits still. So we got some real serious problems with definition. But straighten this out, Alex. Back to you, Alex. K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay. The universal law of gravitation says that two masses attract each other directly proportional and inversely proportional to the square of the distance. Plus there is some sort of a constant that you multiply. So here it is a question. If you have two heavy mass balls and you wiggle one of them, would the outer ball feel the changes of the force? And the answer is yes, the force changes. If you increase the distance of one metal ball from the other, then the other one is going to feel the force decrease. If you wiggle it faster and faster, the other ball is going to feel a faster and faster changing gravitational force. As a matter of fact, how fast is he going to feel it? Nobody knows. Nobody knows what is the speed or velocity of the gravitational wave. Now let me drop it. Now a long wire antenna, that's what I use usually in my logical thinking and making speculations. A long wire antenna, when hooked to a transmitter, the electrons are running up and down on it. Not only one electron, but a huge bunch of electrons. And if you measure it at the end, sometimes it's negative, sometimes it's positive, meaning that it has a surplus of electrons and a deficiency of electrons. Now imagine pointing a long wire antenna to one of those balls that I just mentioned to you. As the electrons move closer to the ball or away from the ball is going to feel the change of the mass of the electron, the force between the mass of the electron and the ball is going to change. In other words, the electrons are producing a gravitational wave. So if you look into this, you are going to find out, let me drop it, you are going to find out that electromagnetic waves are actually electromagnetic gravitational waves. You start your research. In a couple of years, I'm going to hear your name getting a Nobel Prize for this. So that's all I wanted to say. There is a very long theory that I showed on AOL, Romanian International Board. They shut it off. At the time, these international boards were separate by each country. Then I went to the Hungarian board. I speak Hungarian too. And I told them that I presented 16 lessons regarding some new physics, and this is just a small part of it. And they shut down the board. And as I was complaining, finally about 2 or 3 months later, they shut down all the boards. So now there is no more international board on AOL. So you can begin to understand what's going on and why didn't they teach this in school. So that's all I wanted to say. Kilo Charlie 2, Zulu God Zulu, listening to your comments.
Casey 2, QIQ with a comment to that?
Glenn's on the list, but we're going to be going to Bernie before we go to Glenn. And a fascinating theory you put forth there, Alex. And I see a problem. And that is, in the beginning, you and I have a mental image of what the energy that we inject into a dipole, for instance. When I'm injecting energy into a dipole, I'm using my transmitter, I'm putting a significant number of watts of energy down that transmission line, and at one instant of time, I'm launching electrons into the right-hand side of the dipole, and I'm taking them away from the left-hand side. And in the beginning, I did what you just did. I pictured it as a ball of electrons going down that wire, hitting the end of the wire, and coming back. Good mental image at first. Let's go to the next step, and I'll see, and I'll show you why I think it might be an error. I'm going to give you an alternate theory, and we'll be discussing this in future weeks. Let me drop. And this all came about because of the beautiful Gedanken thinking experiment of what happens on a cold winter morning when I start my automobile. Assume on a cold winter morning, I turn the key in the car, and 200 amperes is flowing between the battery on that great big thick piece of copper wire down to my starter motor, and for the first instant, my starter motor has a locked rotor and it's drawing 200 amperes. A lot of current by my standards. And assume I'm watching the red electron. I'm taking these electrons coming out of the negative leads of my battery, and by some magic, I've managed to paint one of them red. And I'm watching the red electron go down that thick piece of copper wire toward the starter motor, and 200 amperes is flowing. And I ask the question, how long would it take for that red electron to get from the battery to the starter motor if the starter motor continuously drew 200 amperes? It would burn up. It couldn't do it. If it continuously drew 200 amperes and the battery could continuously supply 200 amperes, how long would it take for that red electron to get to the starter motor? 3 feet away. At a nanosecond per foot, many an engineer will say he gets there in 3 nanoseconds. He goes a nanosecond per foot, the speed of light, and the 3 feet to go through, 3 nanoseconds. Good sounding answer. Dead wrong. Let me drop. On average, when you study it, you'll find out the red electron coming out of the negative lead of my battery right now, when 200 amperes is flowing, he gets to the starter motor in 4 hours. Ain't that amazing? If Mother Nature would let you do it, if she would allow you to drain all of the free electrons in the copper wire between your battery and your starter motor, if she would allow you to drain those electrons without balancing, you could drain 200 amperes of electrons out of that copper wire for 4 solid hours. What's really happening is that copper wire, the best way you can envision it, it's a hose. It's a hose with a bunch of marbles in it that you and I call electrons. Mother Nature forces you to do a beautiful job of balancing. When one marble pops out of the far end of that hose and goes into the starter motor, she insists that you will put one marble into the input end to balance it at that instant of time. I'll admit that if you change the current, and how long does the sense of the current change? In other words, I'm speeding up or slowing down the marbles flowing through this pipe. In other words, my starter motor starts drawing 150 amperes instead of 200 amperes. How soon will the battery sense the difference? That pressure wave, that decrease in pressure wave, travels up that pipe of marbles, and the battery will sense it in 3 nanoseconds. The battery will sense the change in rate of flow in 3 nanoseconds, but still, on average, 4 hours are required. So, you and I think we're putting a great big cloud of electrons into a wire when we're charging that wire, whether it be for the solder motor or whether it be for our antenna. We're really jiggling electrons in a pipe. And a few of those electrons are moving to the right, and we think we're putting a negative charge onto that side of the dipole.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
We're really wiggling marbles in a pipe of our antenna. If I now calculate how far do the electrons move up and down the wire of my antenna on each half cycle of 3.5 megacycles, when I press down the key at 80 meters, those electrons are moving nanometers. They're moving very, very little. They're just marbles wiggling in a pipe. It's not a great big cloud of electrons going to the end of the antenna, making a significant gravity wave. Good image, but I think you see the problem once you study the solder motor example. And by the way, that example of the solder motor was in a beautiful book called Thinking Physics by Epstein. When you get a hold of that book, it's about a $30 book, paperback book, extremely well done with examples like this. So the number of electrons and the weight of them that you're really putting in the wire is nowhere near what you think they are. When Mr. Cavendish did that experiment to measure the gravity constant, because he was a great big heavy guy, he came up with a reasonably big error when he came up with the gravity constant, because him, alongside of his great big bowling balls and great big long suspended strings, and he's measuring the torsion due to torsional twist because of gravity of the two balls attracting each other, him standing alongside of the apparatus, this great big 300-pound man, made a significant error. Over to you for a comment on this one, Alex. KC2, Zulu, K2LAW on the TechNet.
As we studied, electrons are traveling from molecule to molecule. So each one molecule releases another electron, goes into another molecule, and that releases an electron, and so on. What I'm saying to you, that if you, the end of the antenna, what's coming out, another example, if you have a CRT tube, you have a lot of electrons that actually travel very fast, maybe as fast as the speed of light. They are coming out from the metal. They are coming up from the filament, actually from the cathode that's heated by the filament. But they exist, and they travel at very, very high, and they have a mass. So what I imagine, that probably I was right, I'm not so sure at this point, if you measure at the end of an antenna a change of a high negative field, and it goes into a high positive field, then a bunch of electrons have to disappear from there, then it's when it becomes positive, and has to fill it up, that's when it becomes negative. That's the end of long wire antenna. So maybe you should do your experiments with a CRT tube in your mind, and think of the electrons leaving the cathode as going back and forth, or tracing a line on a CRT, and do those electrons have an effect on the mass around them, as far as gravitation goes? So maybe next time I'm going to fill up with you a little bit. This is Kilo Charlie 2 Zulu Golf Zulu, signing out for tonight.
Yeah, fascinating material you brought to our attention tonight, Alex. It's a real thinking experiment. And as you can tell, there's multiple ways of looking at it. And I'm not sure we've gotten to the bottom of it yet. But like everything else, it's a little bit more complicated when you get down to the molecular level than you think. And the way electrons flow, and that one single electron leaves your antenna or leaves my antenna when I'm transmitting, except for some leakage of it touching the leaves of the tree, and then they're wet, if you know what I mean. But except for that, no electrons leave the antenna. Electrons are flowing. Current is flowing. The current flowing makes a magnetic field. It is my belief over the last couple of weeks that the magnetic field is the majority of what starts the radiation process. I can't prove it. just got a strong gut feel that that's a major portion of the process. And the E field is the method, but the H field is what's doing the work. Very similar to moving that motor, moving my automobile, moving my loudspeaker, moving my earphones. The magnetics are really doing the work. And here we are ignoring magnetics for so damn many years. Let's see, Lou's going to straighten us out on this. Those guys out there in Port Jefferson, they know what's going on. WY2H, K2RIW. Go ahead, Lou.
Hey, good evening, all, and good evening to you, Dick. Very interesting this evening. I wanted you to comment on something we talked about once, and I was rather surprised at the observation that you had. It had to do with, if we imagine a radio wave traveling some distance, and you imagine the electric field and the orthogonal magnetic field alternating, coming, you know, fully charged and then going back to zero and then coming back again in a cyclic fashion at the frequency. Comment on the relationship in time between when, say, the electric field collapses and the magnetic field collapses. When we discussed it, I thought it was totally different, and you straightened me out on it. And I think it's one of these things that common beliefs out there are different than what reality is. So I thought, based on your previous discussion, this might be a good point just to spend a minute or two on. Back to you, NY2H.
Yeah, great question, Lou. Many people view a E field or an H field as a sinusoidal thing. In other words, at your point of observation, when this wave is coming at you, at one instant of time, the E field is positive up, it goes through zero, and eventually becomes positive down, and then goes through zero again. That's one way of looking at it. My newest way of looking at it is it's a sheet of material. I've got a whole bunch of parallel sheets where each sheet is, let me say, a half wavelength apart in the direction of propagation. I've got a whole bunch of stacked up sheets, like a ream of paper, so to speak. And so one sheet of material is coming toward my antenna. If it's a vertically polarized wave, that sheet of energy has lines running up and down, which represent E field. It's got lines running back and forth that represent H field. The very next sheet behind that sheet is identical, except that both of them are in opposite polarization. So I've got a positive sheet, half wavelength behind that is a negative sheet, half wavelength that behind that is a positive sheet, and all of these sheets are coming at me at the speed of light. And depending on the spacing between those sheets, that determines what frequency I sense when I listen to the signal coming out of that antenna. Let me drop. And so, as I'm halfway between the positive sheet and the negative sheet, I'm going through an area where there is zero energy. And this is opposite of common sense. One third of the good books on electromagnetic waves have it wrong. And because if I took an ordinary resonant circuit, an inductor and a capacitor, and they're in parallel with each other, and I resonate them at 3.5 megacycles, we'll say, and I got a 3.5 meg sine wave going through that parallel resonant LC circuit. I can sense it with my grid dip meter. I can throw a power into it with my op amp, with my transmitter, whatever. And I, at the instant the voltage is maximum on that LC circuit, essentially all of the energy is in the capacitor. 1/2 CV squared tells me how much energy is in the capacitor, and that's in units of joules. And at that instant of time when the voltage is maximum, no current is flowing. Therefore, there is no energy in the coil, in the inductor. A quarter of a cycle later, the voltage is going through zero. 1/2 CV squared, there's no energy in the capacitor. The voltage is changing at the maximum rate as it goes through zero. The current through the inductor is maximum. And now all the energy at that instant of time is in the inductor. 1/2 LI squared, again in joules. So the energy is trading back and forth between the inductor and the capacitor twice per cycle. energy is trading back and forth, bouncing back and forth between the inductor and the capacitor. You and I call that resonance. Let me drop. By that similar thinking, a hell of a lot of good electromagnetic theory books will show you a electromagnetic wave in space, and they have the E field and the H field trading energy back and forth. Good sounding common sense relates to an LC circuit. Dead wrong. The way that E field in space and H field in space works, in my mind, it is a sheet of energy, like a sheet of paper, coming at me flat, coming toward me in a flat manner. It contains E, it contains H, all the energy of that half of that cycle is in that sheet. At the instant the E in the electromagnetic wave in free space, at the instant the E is maximum, at that instant and at that point, the H is simultaneously maximum. When the E goes through zero, the H also goes through zero. And then the next sheet behind it, which is out of phase, the E is now maximum in the opposite direction, the H is maximum in the opposite direction. So each of these sheets are bundles of energy that I call a sheet of material coming at you. It is not the energy trading back and forth between E and H. These are photons, bundles of energy, where the E and the H for each half cycle are grouped together. Ain't that crazy? How in the world did it ever come out that way? I'm almost positive that's what it is. You make careful measurements of phase angle of H and phase angle of E, and you'll say, holy cow, why didn't they tell me that in school? Maybe this is a little bit helpful in the direction of your question. I may have missed your question, Boo. NY2H, K2RIW.
Dick, that's only at the point of permissivity, KC2QIQ.
I'm talking about in free space, a real TEM wave in free space. I claim behaves in that manner, Glenn. We'll get back to you in a minute. Lou, go ahead.
All righty, very fine. My mission here is done. I've stirred the pot. I'm going to sit back and listen. This is NY2H.
Hey, Lou, tell me what was your motive. I think you're of the opinion that a lot of people have it the other way around. A lot of the books, one-third of the books have got it wrong. And this is a somewhat controversial area. And I think you wanted to shed some light on it. Is that approximately what's going on here, Lou? Back to you, Lou.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I was floored when I first heard that. And but it makes sense. And your latest remarks show that I guess you empirically have measured that also. So, but I want you guys to hash it out. I was taught that. I must have had one of the one-third of the books that had that. And I always pictured one wave collapsing, and somehow the collapse of the one wave generated the energy in the other, and back and forth, just as you had said. So, in all of the subject matter that was addressed tonight, I thought that you probably didn't want to miss that, and that's good. So I'm going to listen out. K2RIWNY2H.
Now, let me show you, there's another hint that we had that was very well hidden. We've all heard the word in our electromagnetic theory course, pointing vector. And one of the definitions of pointing vector is you've got a vector of E, you've got a vector of H. They each have a magnitude and a direction at one point in space, at one instant of time. The magnitude of the pointing vector, the amount of energy in the wave at that instant of time, is E crossed H. You're doing a vector cross product of the vector of E cross product into H. If it was like an LC circuit, where at the instant the E is maximum, the H is zero, and vice versa, you would always be doing a multiplication where one of the multiple cans would be zero. You'd have a hell of a lot of zeros for what you think is the energy of the electromagnetic wave. Yes, there is a real zero in between the positive half wave and the negative half wave. The positive half wave is one bundle of energy. The negative half wave, the next sheet behind it, is another bundle of energy. And there's a zero in between the two. And those bundles are moving through space at the speed of light, coming at you and hitting your antenna and depositing their energy in little bundles, is one way of looking at it. Photons. E cross H to work. It can't be like an LC circuit where the energy is bouncing back and forth between E and H. E and H have to simultaneously be present at each peak of the wave in order for the peak